Good morning. It's 8:59. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This program is made possible by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Nonesuch Records, now featuring the Magnetic Fields 50-song memoir, an album that chronicles the 50 years of songwriter Stephen Merritt's life with one song per year. The Magnetic Fields 50-song memoir available.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of A Night with Steve Early, Monday, March 20th at the Portland State University Bookstore in Portland. Steve Early, author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, will speak and discuss his book, which chronicles the 15 years of successful community organizing to create the progressive transformation of Richmond, California. Again, that's A Night with Steve Early, Monday, March 20th at the Portland State University Bookstore at 1715 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The KBOO Community Radio Artists in Residence Program application period is open. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KBOO mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The Artists in Residence program is open to artists of all disciplines whose project proposals include sound as a major component. Applications for the KBOO 2017 Artists in Residence are due Friday, April 7th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/kboo AIR 2017.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO here in Portland, where the time is now 9:01, and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Joe Clement. The mole is the beast that works underground to both expose and undermine the entrenched power structures that lie behind and below the surface of our commodified world. At the core of this world is the social arrangement we call capitalism, which gives the control of labor and the products of labor to the small and very wealthy elite, who are permitted to own the wealth we all produce and to manage it in their own interests. The history of this system over recent years has now led us to the prospect of 4 years of governance by a president and a party with a record of utter disregard for the well-being of most of us, and eager to turn over even more of our world to private ownership. Immigration and health care are two major issues the Trump administration is acting on and about which resistance is growing. So on today's show, we will hear the second part of Desiree Heliger's interview with Ramon Ramirez, president of the Oregon Farmworker Union, PICUN, about organizing in the wake of the recent ICE raids in Woodburn, the ongoing impacts of Measure 88, and the role of U.S. policies in driving immigration from Mexico. Jan Hocken will be here to talk with Patricia Kullberg about her new book, On the Ragged Edge of Medicine, Doctoring Among the Dispossessed. Kullberg is a doctor who worked for decades at Multnomah County Downtown Clinics and talks about what she learned from her patients and what their stories told her about the sickness of the healthcare system. And Bill Resnick will be here to talk with Steve Early about his new book about Richmond, California, Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. They'll discuss how the Progressive Alliance has worked over the years to get a majority on the city council and what they plan to do in addition to pressing Chevron to stop pollution from their Richmond refinery. And I'll have a commentary about having faith in socialism. We're going to lead off then with Ramon Ramirez talking with Desiree Heligers about the impact of ICE raids on the Woodburn community. ICE is the federal agency, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. This is part two of a two-part interview, and it opens with Ramirez talking about how U.S. foreign policy drives immigration to the U.S.
To a large extent, our economic and foreign policies towards countries like Mexico and Central America are causing illegal immigration. You know, we don't treat countries to the south as economic partners. We look at those countries as a way to exploit their natural resources and exploit their people that create the conditions that the reasons why people immigrate illegally into this country. I was in Mexico a few years ago where the farmers were saying that they cannot compete with U.S. farmers who are selling the majority of their products to their government. And the Mexican government were no longer buying from the small growers in their country because they were able to buy on the market cheaper corn, rice, beans, soy, dry milk. To a large part because the U.S. was subsidizing the U.S. growers so that they could sell the product on the international market at a lower price. So the Mexican government was buying it at a lower price while creating economic devastation to the small farmers in Mexico who had to sell their land and come into the U.S. as undocumented workers.
Right, and NAFTA has certainly driven a lot.
And NAFTA is a good example of that. So, I mean, you know, we have some serious economic problems in the hemisphere, and the American people don't realize that they eat a lot cheaper, and they think that, you know, they don't realize that somebody's paying a price. And who's paying the price is the immigrant farm worker. The life expectancy rate of a farm worker in the United States, you know, 90% of the farm workers are immigrants, is 49 years of age. We have 25% more cancer rate than the general population. Miscarriages among farm worker women are 50% higher than the general population. We're working with dangerous pesticides day in and day out. There's child labor still happening in the United States. And the American people are benefiting from this, but yet the farm worker's paying the price. You might, on the front end, pay cheaper for your food, which we are in America, but somebody's paying a price.
So the farm workers are literally subsidizing the food for...
And dying for it. Because, you know, I mean, when you have 50% miscarriages among farm worker women, that's unacceptable. 49 years of age is the life expectancy of a farm worker. That's incredible. You know, farm workers are literally dying to put food on the table.
Can we talk a little bit about the issue of driver's licenses? Because, you know, we saw Measure 88 a couple of years ago shoot down the legislation that had been passed in Oregon that made Oregon driver's licenses available to undocumented people. So Measure 88 basically shot that down and kind of recriminalized people who are just basically trying to drive in order to sustain their families.
Well, as a result of that, we've have probably over 90,000 people who had at one time an Oregon driver's license lose their driver's license. And for the most part, most people are driving without a license and don't have insurance. And we always looked at it as a public safety issue and not as a immigration issue. Measure 88 was done primarily through a multimillionaire in Nevada who gave, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to make sure that Measure 88 passed. And that's how they were able to pass it, right? During the time that it was signed by the governor, during the time it got passed in the House and Senate, it was never an immigration issue, it was a public safety issue. But the right wing and the anti-immigrant groups in Oregon, you know, they promoted it as an immigration problem.
One of the participants in that was the Oregonians for Immigration Reform.
That's correct. Oregonians for Immigration Reform. And, you know, they were able to convince the voting public that this was a danger. In fact, the candidates who had voted for the Senate bill, 833, that led to the signing of by the governor, were targeted by the same millionaire. There was hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on a number of candidates who had supported that measure to try to take them out. In fact, none of them actually lost their election, but the ugliness of racism, of xenophobia, of indifference by these folks who were promoting Measure 88. Ugly side of humanity showed itself. And, you know, I always tell people that, you know, we need to build a new society based on respect and dignity for all. We have to build bridges of understanding among our communities. In 20 years, you know, the people of color in this country will be the majority. And I always ask my brothers and sisters who are people of color, do we want to build the same society as we have now, status quo, you know, based on racism, indifference, where we don't honor diversity, where we attack each other? Or do we want to build a new society where everybody has a place in it, you know, where we honor the diversity of our cultures and of our histories, of our customs? Do we want to build a house where we bring in, you know, folks of color, workers, gay folks, you know, immigrants, refugees, and we're all working together to solve our common problems together? That's the kind of society I want to teach my kids how to build, right? And, you know, I think a new world is possible, but we do, in the meantime, have to work against these immigration raids. We have to try to reestablish driver's license for people, because we're really truly putting the public at risk here.
And also, it seems like any time that somebody gets arrested without a driver's license now under these new executive orders,
they're subject to deportation proceedings.
Right, so something as just minor as driving to work now can result in deportation.
Right. So, in closing, I would just add that, you know, there's a number of organizations doing immigrant rights work. PECUN is certainly one of them, CALSA, Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition. There's a sanctuary movement up in Portland. There's VOS, for example, that these organizations are in need of funds. Our resources are being drained at this moment. We're trying our best to provide legal defense to people. We're trying to get lawyers who want to perform on a pro bono basis in contact with immigrants that really need it. A lot of families are, you know, are getting their loved ones who are the sole providers in their family deported, so they have no resources. So we need to start gathering resources, food, you know, money together. So if you have a chance to donate whatever you can, volunteer also is a good way. You don't have to actually give money, but volunteering is another good way of helping out. Please do that. We have a website. It's pcun.org. And then we do have a, we're on Facebook. So if you want to volunteer, if you want to donate any money, we are forming a raid resistance network here. And any funds that we collect will be dedicated to those, to that network, to ensure that we continue educating people about what the rights are. We create some kind of fund so that, you know, local community people can access it to get, you know, pay a rent or buy food for people, you know, things like that. And, you know, honestly speaking, I don't know how long we can sustain that. But what we do know is that we have to increase the public pressure. And I truly believe that we could stop Trump. We could stop his policy of madness. And if we don't do that, I truly believe that all the rights of the people are in danger here. So we need to really come together.
Ramon, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.
This has been Desiree Hellegers with the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You've been listening to an interview with Ramon Ramirez, president of PECUN, the Oregon Farm Workers Union. When the interview posts in the next couple of days on the KBOO website, we will include links to some of the many organizations mentioned in today's interview. Those organizations are urgently in need of funds and volunteers to enable them to continue to respond to the unfolding assault against immigrant rights and the ICE raids in Oregon.
I'm for telling the truth, exposing the lies. Think about the dead soldiers when you're driving your ride. The people die for the war, Daddy Bush's revenge. I'm with the widows, the children, and the lonely best friends. I'm for families staying together as one. I'm not for the raids and the deportations. I'm with Victor Toro and the MIR. So watch out for them snitches in their unmarked car. And for Lil Salito, we gon' fight for your moms. So we go. gone, shot her out twice in one solo with the 12 million workers and then Vita Adiano for a world without borders and a better tomorrow.
And that's a bit from Rebel Diaz. Which side are you on? Following up on Desiree Helliger's interview with Ramon Ramirez here on the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was part two of a two-part interview, and links to both of them will be posted on the Old Mole webpage for today's show. And by the way, you can always find our shows posted there, where you can listen to them again and recommend them to your friends. Today's show will be up in a day or two. I'm Clayton Morgridge, and in a minute I'll have some thoughts to share about believing that socialism is possible. But first, here are a few items from the Old Mole action calendar for the coming week. This Thursday at noon in Salem, Unite Oregon is holding a rally on the Capitol steps. That's on March 16th, which is the day the new Muslim ban goes into effect. Unite Oregon is an advocacy group for inclusion and diversity. So that's this Thursday at noon in Salem on the Capitol steps. Later on Thursday, starting at 7 p.m., there will be a Mayor's Town Hall on Portland's climate priorities, and you are invited to contribute to the discussion of what Portland can do to prepare for the impacts of climate change. Mayor Ted Wheeler will be there. This will be at Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont, from 7 to 8 p.m. There's no charge, but you are asked to reserve a space on eventbrite.com. On Friday, Peace and Justice Works Iraq Affinity Group is co-sponsoring the March 17th Portland Peaceful Response Coalition Friday Rally with the theme, "The Quagmire Continues, 14 Years in Iraq." The rally begins at 5 p.m. at Portland, at the Pioneer Courthouse Square, with a march around downtown beginning at 5:20. I'll have a few more events where you can stand up for justice later in the show. But now, here is my commentary about why it makes sense to believe that a different and far better world is possible. With the election of Trump and the rise of extreme right-wing parties elsewhere in the world, we have reached a stage in the history of capitalism that seems to confirm the title of a book published some 20 years ago, Socialism or Barbarism. If the world continues to be organized around the use of nature and human life and labor to maximize the growth of capital, it now seems clear that we are on a path to barbarism or fascism, aimed at serving and protecting the super rich in their estates and enclaves, while sequestering the rest of the population in servitude and incarceration. The time then seems ripe for a movement for everyone who has no access to a livelihood except by selling themselves to capital, to remake the world so that our labor is really ours and serves the well-being of us all. Socialism is the challenge to the right to privately own and manage the wealth we have all worked to produce. It proposes that together we could manage our work in the world for the benefit of all of us, that we can work for all of us and not just for those whose only work is to channel the wealth we produce into their own pockets. Socialism looks towards a world in which we work not for wages, but for the contribution our work makes to our common life. Whole civilizations and economies, from ancient times to the United States before 1865, were built on slavery. In the Middle Ages, the unpaid labor of serfs made the aristocracy rich and powerful. Wage labor, too, can vanish one day, for like slavery and serfdom, hired labor is, in Marx's words, a transitory and inferior form destined to disappear before associated labor plying its toil with a willing hand, a ready mind, and a joyous heart. The idea of a world of mutual aid, one in which we all work gladly for the well-being of us all, is often called utopian, meaning impractical or impossible. This skepticism can stop people from giving it further thought. First, there are doubts about whether capitalism could ever be overcome. Its ideology is too entrenched, and it has the immense power of the state on its side. And then there are objections to the very possibility of living and working together on the basis of voluntary cooperation. For one thing, human beings are, by nature, self-centered and greedy for possessions and power. For another, a society as complex and massive as the U.S., let alone the global society, could not possibly be organized without some kind of authoritarian structure, without being directed from the top down, as are corporations and nation-states. That's why communist revolutions have always ended up as tyrannies. Now, these things may be true, but then again, they might not be. Systems of belief and forms of life have disappeared in the past. There is plenty of evidence that human beings value and practice cooperation, and that many people work hard for little or no pay because they believe in the value of what they are doing. And it could well be possible that a way of coordinating voluntary work in a mass society to meet our needs could be developed. Only time and effort can decide these questions. But if we decide in advance that a better world is not possible, we will not try the experiment to see if it is. Since there is no way to know in advance whether working for a better world, a cooperative world, will succeed, our decision to join the fight or to sit on the sidelines is in effect a bet. We are staking our lives on one outcome or the other, socialism or barbarism. Let's consider what the possible outcomes are, what we gain and what we lose if we bet correctly or incorrectly. Consider first the results of betting optimistically that socialism is possible. The best outcome, of course, is that we are right. We win not only the bet, but a better world. Moreover, we have spent our lives working in solidarity with others and in harmony with our deepest shared beliefs about what is good and just. But suppose we are wrong. Socialism is impossible, and we have wasted our lives trying to bring it about. But wait, have we really? We still had the satisfaction of fighting the good fight and working for what we believe in solidarity with others. So this is not the best outcome, but it still results in a life well spent. Now consider the results of betting pessimistically that socialism is utterly impossible. If we win this bet, then we have the satisfaction of knowing we were right and that we didn't waste our lives working for an illusion. But that is just the sour satisfaction of being able to say, "I told you so." We have lost the chance to be on the side of the angels, and we lived a life without hope. On the other hand, what if we lose this bet? Socialism was possible, but we wagered against it. Then perhaps socialism comes to pass, but we had nothing to do with it and lived our lives without hope and without being part of the victory celebration. Or perhaps socialism was possible, but only if we worked for it, and having bet against it, we lose and fall into barbarism. That is the worst possible outcome. Another world was within our grasp, but we blew it, with catastrophic consequences for all. So all told, the results of betting that another, better world is possible are far better than the results of betting that the world under capitalism is here to stay. We cannot act politically without betting on something we cannot foresee, the future. But we can foresee that win or lose, socialism or barbarism, a life dedicated to winning socialism is better than the one apathetically resigned to barbarism. A couple of months ago on The Old Mole, I read a piece by Ruth Potts, published in Red Pepper, in defense of the utopian imagination. Her argument was that utopian dreams are a catalyst for the oppressed and marginalized. They remind us that other worlds are possible and give us the hope which makes action possible. Utopia is immediate and polemical, a prompt to dream and to act. It affects immediate changes in the real world now, the belief that the world could be fairer
and life better spurs us on and creates the space in which change is possible. I'm Clayton Morgeridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And that's Louis Armstrong with My Sweet, a piece of happy music by which to think positive, optimistic thoughts about a better world. Here on the Old Mole Variety Hour on Portland's only listener-sponsored, listener-operated KBOO. Well, if you're a regular listener to the Old Mole, you've probably heard us mention our engineer, Patsy Kullberg. Patsy is also a novelist and a physician. And the Old Mole's Jan Hocken is here to talk with her now about her new nonfiction work on the ragged edge of medicine, Doctoring Among the Dispossessed. Jan.
Well, Patricia Kullberg, welcome to this side of the studio this morning.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
You were medical director at the Multnomah County Health Department for many years and worked as a primary care doctor at downtown county clinics. The stories in your book, On the Ragged Edge of Medicine, are inspired by that work. And they begin with a present and complaint, like most medical narratives. But the symptoms you describe are not easily brought under control, particularly for poor people and others on the social margins. And that's very much a kind of running theme throughout the book. Can you say a little bit about what you hope to convey through this book project about doctoring with people on the social margins?
Yeah, I think the original impulse for writing these stories was to come to terms with the bad things that happen. Bad things happen in any kind of medical practice, but particularly in this location with people who were very distressed economically. A lot of outcomes were not what I expected. They were not good, and sometimes they were partly my fault too. So I originally took pen to paper or fingers to keyboard to try to come to terms with those things that happened and understand why and what my own role might have been. But the other thing was that I wanted to bear witness to the lives of these people. I wanted to try to draw a connection between the ways, the very specific ways that they suffered, and to the institutions of power, to the economic, social, and political institutions that were really at the root of the ways they were forced to live and the ways that they suffered. I wanted to bear witness to that. I think as a society, it is not good for us to not look, to not see, to ignore the people who are most vulnerable among us. I don't think that makes for a healthy community. I think that diminishes our humanity. I think that exacerbates problems of criminality, substance abuse, homelessness. We need to see these people.
And there, you really balance effectively in this book two tendencies and kind of work between them. One is to cast people as utterly abject in their state of need and want, and as a bundle of lacks, lacking capacity. And the other is this kind of resilient survivor story. And I think one of the lovely accounts that captures this, both this idea of people suffering needlessly, but also being resourceful in the face of it, is of a woman who figures out how to survive by spending the night outside of intensive care units around the city and rotating from hospital to hospital because no one's going to question you. And it was a creative way to get through the night. And this is one example of that throughout.
Right. There were many stories like that. And people really did try to take control of their lives, and they would make demands, and they would make their own decisions, and they weren't just passive victims in their lives. And sometimes they put me on the spot. They would make me do things that I didn't necessarily hadn't thought to do. There's a story about that, about a patient with chronic disease who, you know, I'm off on trying to make a diagnosis, and she basically says, "No, wait, that's, you know, in her own way, you got to attend to me. This is my issue, and this is what you need to do for me." And I have to, you know, I have to comply with that.
There was, also this theme throughout of being a doctor in context where the problems people present with are so tied to the complicated aspects of their lives, the unhealthy or self-defeating, as well as being self-defeating, as well as being defeated at every turn in the society they live in, and that American medicine is oriented toward interventions that contain or eradicate symptoms. And you're dealing with things that are much more like social work, chronic. And what do you think that calls for that's different from the way you were trained as a doctor and how American medicine is kind of oriented to sickness or pathology?
Well, I think that brings us around to kind of the topic of storytelling in medicine, which is where we always start. With story, the patient tells the story, and we
about what brought them in. Yeah, that's also called the presenting complaints,
history of present illness, and what the practitioner wants to do is reconstruct that story into a medical narrative, and there's always this impulse to do that. Now, the stories that patients bring in are wonderful. They're full of detail about how patients suffer, about the meaning of their illnesses, about their daily existence. But stories are also very problematic for a practitioner because, you know, they're not linear. They're a little chaotic. They might be diversionary. There might be outright lies there. There might be irrelevancy. So there's always this struggle to take this story and craft it into something which is clinical, that makes sense to me, that is amenable to the tools that I have, and that is of necessity narrowed down really to more of what we call a disease rather than an illness.
That fits within the frame of the medical model as well.
Right, a pathological process rather than a patient experience. And this is not, you know, recasting the disease as an illness is not simply a nicety. It makes us feel warm and fuzzy and good toward the patient. It's also actually essential to crafting an effective therapeutic alliance and an effective therapeutic plan. And there's a story in the book about my failure over months to control this fellow's blood pressure. And it's precisely because I don't understand the nitty-gritty detail of his life. And there are a lot of reasons why I don't, that the story kind of goes into that.
There's a delightful story that I think illustrates the same theme about the stethoscope. And you describe a clinical interaction where you're listening to a woman's lungs and then her heart and diagnosing, I believe, a heart murmur. But part of the story centers on the stethoscope as a device for listening or not listening to patients. And can you say a little bit about that story?
Yeah, this woman came in and she didn't know she had a leaky heart valve. And, you know, and I use my stethoscope to listen to her heart instead of listening to her. And I find she's got this leaky valve and it's going to kill her. But lucky for me, lucky for her, we have this marvelous Western scientific medical technology. We can replace the valve and we can save her life. Well, she's got this whole other story, this secret story that she can't tell me. She won't tell me. I never really figure out what it is that stands between her and accepting this therapy. She does not want to have the surgery. And I really struggled to understand what was going on with this woman. And I found that I had great tools for diagnosing her heart murmur. I really did not know how to read her as one would read a novel, you know, how to suss out what her fears or anxieties were, or what was in her background.
The subtext of the communication.
Yeah, I wasn't trained to do that, and I was lost.
And in that sense, the stethoscope becomes a metaphor for kind of the two-edged sword of the tools of your trade.
Exactly.
That the device that helps you listen can also serve as a defense or a barrier from really listening.
Yeah, precisely. Arthur Kleinman is a psychiatrist and an anthropologist who writes brilliantly about medicine, and he suggested that the project of medicine was really about transforming chaotic human problems into problems that were practical issues that could be managed through medical technology. And I think that is the kind of the central impulse, driving impulse behind Western scientific medicine and how it's practiced. And so why do we do that? I think the main reason that we do that is to reduce uncertainty. That uncertainty, not being able to name what is going on and to control it, is very uncomfortable for both patient and practitioner.
So when we rethink healthcare and go beyond even the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, it's important to raise these larger questions about not just access, but what it means to have a democratic, more humane vision of a healthcare system and a healthy society.
Yeah. There's a movement in medicine called narrative medicine, which is really about training practitioners to attend to story.
And that is actually the group that's supporting you, that is sponsoring your talk tomorrow
that's
night.
Correct.
And just in closing, can you say a bit about this event tomorrow night? And that's, I understand, open and free.
Yes, to the
open
public.
Open to public and free.
Yes. OHSU, tomorrow evening, Tuesday, 7 to 8:30, I'll be talking about storytelling in medicine, or storytelling in the exam room, and reading some excerpts from my book and having a discussion. And that's at the Clinical Life Sciences Building.
Collaborative Life Sciences Building, second floor auditorium. That's 2730 Southwest Moody Collaborative Life Science Building. It's on the west end of the Tillicum Crossing bridge, big building.
Right.
And then later this month, you're also doing a book launch reading.
At Broadway Books on Tuesday, March 21st, also at 7 p.m.
Well, congratulations, Patricia Kohlberg, also known as Patsy Kohlberg, on this fabulous book, On the Ragged Edge of Medicine. And it's a wonderful project. And I hope it inspires other ways of rethinking healthcare and medicine in this country.
Great. Thank you so much, Jan.
That's Gillian Welch with One More Dollar. And before that, we heard Jan Hocken talking with Patsy Kohlberg about her new book, On the Ragged Edge of Medicine, Doctoring Among the Dispossessed. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge, and here are a couple more things for the Old Mole's action calendar. Some of you might be old enough to remember marching against the Iraq War before it started. Can you believe it's going on 14 years later? This Friday, Peace and Justice Works, an Iraq affinity group, is co-sponsoring the March 17th Portland Peaceful Response Coalition Friday Rally with the theme, The Quagmire Continues, 14 Years in Iraq. That begins at 5 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square with a march around downtown beginning about 5:20. Then on Saturday, downtown in the park blocks, there is a rally against hateful borders. Organizers are hoping to pack the park blocks to show support for immigrants and refugees while maintaining a nonviolent, peaceful atmosphere with activities planned such as voter registration and distributing phone numbers of elected officials so that people can make calls during the rally. And this evening in Vancouver, there is a Poor People's Rally organized by CHAP, that's Concerned Humans Against Poverty. That's at the Vancouver City Hall at 6 p.m. That's at 415 West 6th in Vancouver. And if you are an IWW member, new or old, or are thinking about joining that union, there is a class you would want to take called Intro to the IWW 101. That's going to be held on Wednesday, March 15th, this coming Wednesday, at the IWW offices at 2249 East Burnside Street here in Portland. And that's Wednesday from starting at 6:30. Now, to wrap up today's Old Mole, Bill Resnick is in the studio to talk with Steve Early about the city of Richmond's fight against Chevron and progressives' control of the city council. Bill.
Thanks, Clayton, and we can add to your activist community list. Steve Early is going to be in town this weekend. We'll talk about it, but I want to talk now to Steve. Hi, welcome to KABU.
Thanks for having me on again, Bill.
Yeah, Steve Early is a labor journalist, an activist, a writer. His latest book is A Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of American City. That city is Richmond, California, about 10 miles up the highway from San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley, a couple of small towns, and then Richmond at the end of the BART line. It's working class, very diverse. The home of Chevron's biggest West Coast oil refinery, also the home of a lot of community activists who formed the Richmond Progressive Alliance. It challenged Chevron. It didn't just beat them. It also created a political force that now on most issues controls Richmond city policy. And it is a very ambitious agenda, real alternatives for the city, including on housing, energy, schools, health, transit, and more. Steve Early's coming to Portland again, speaking this Sunday evening at the First Unitarian Church at 7 o'clock, and next Monday night, a week from today, at Portland State, also at 7 at the bookstore. So, Steve, your book and talks are, to say the least, very timely for those who haven't noticed. Donald Trump is now U.S. president, and he's supported by a fiercely right-wing Congress out for blood and out to destroy the left, who they hate, destroy their achievements of the last century, all the way from Social Security to environmental protection, civil rights protection, and much more. Trump has to be stopped. Every progressive writer points that out. It is the cities and states that oppose Trump and the right that they're our best hope. Richmond gives us a wonderful example. Steve, tell us the story of the Richmond Progressive Alliance.
Well, the Richmond Progressive Alliance got started 12, 14 years ago during a similar dark time, the early years of the Bush administration. A lot of people were pretty demoralized and divided and frustrated in the wake of the 2000 election. In Richmond, a group of Greens who had supported Ralph Nader decided to go local in politics and do it in, I think, more ecumenical and effective fashion than just waving the Green Party banner. They formed a coalition with dissident Democrats and people in different socialist groups and independent voters and created a local electoral force that over the last 12 years has succeeded in electing winning 10 out of 16 municipal elections for city council and mayor. And as you mentioned, there's now a progressive supermajority on the council, 5 out of 7 members. And for 8 years, this group, the RPA, made Richmond the largest city in the country with a green mayor, Gail McLaughlin.
And tell us about their strategy for building that alliance. It had setbacks over the years, but they kept coming. And it was many years.
Yeah, one of the things that's distinguished the RPA from other local political formations is that it's a hybrid organization. It's a membership group, about 300 to 400 Richmond residents pay $12 a year in dues. They elect a steering committee. They have a storefront office. The group has some labor and community organizational affiliates, some progressive unions and some groups that organize around immigrant rights and housing and other environmental issues. The group just doesn't pop up at election time. It's a year-round community organizing vehicle. And it has a common platform for its candidates, none of whom accept corporate donations or business contributions in any form. So when it fields a slate of candidates, they run as a team, as a ticket, and they reflect ongoing year-round organizing around a wide range of community issues.
And they're active during the years. I've been in Richmond a couple times and helped in one of the elections. They're very active. They've got a very active educational and outreach program, and they're very diverse. Richmond is a really working-class town, and a lot of poor people and struggling people. It's Latino and Black and many other ethnicities, and the racial composition is quite diverse. How did it all come together?
Well, as you note, it's an 80% non-white city. It came together over time. People who were going local in politics, whether in response to the Bush era or the Trump era, have to be patient, they have to be persistent, they have to educate themselves about the minutiae of a lot of public policy questions that they may not have immersed themselves in before. But over time, a great deal of expertise was developed. People began to play an important role, not only in elected positions, but during Gail McLaughlin's mayoral administration. A lot of progressives got appointed to key positions on the Planning Commission, on the Housing Commission, Parks and Recreation, the oversight body that monitors the police. I'm a member of the City Personnel Board. People are able to make a contribution to the shaping of city policy and the administration of city government in lots of different ways when you start to win elected positions.
Yeah, Chevron is, to say the least, not very happy with you, with the Richmond Progressive Alliance. That was their first target, the pollution as well as the huge explosion that happened, safety issues at the Chevron plant. And pouring emissions into the Chevron in the neighborhoods of Richmond. They were defeated with just immense grassroots support. Chevron, though, poured a lot of money into those campaigns and found their own candidates very diverse, and they give money to the little churches and clubs. They try and spread it around. How did you beat them?
Well, Chevron is part of a very powerful but not atypical conservative coalition that dominated city politics, city life for many years. It includes the Chamber of Commerce, the Manufacturers Association, developers, conservative building trades unions, and police and firefighters who often in the past, through their unions, have been allies of the city's largest employer, Chevron. The only way to counter the influence of that kind of big money and those kind of conservative forces in politics is to build up a strong grassroots organization with a year-round program of political activity. Another thing that helped was winning public financing. We have a modest system of matching funds, which rewards our candidates for municipal office who have the capacity, like Bernie Sanders, to develop a base of small donors. And so those public matching funds have helped level the playing field a little bit. But what's overcome the huge spending of big oil, big soda, the real estate lobby last fall was grassroots organization, canvassing, developing hundreds of campaign volunteers. They've been able, that kind of grassroots army has been able to overcome the paid canvassers and the ads and the mailers and the whole advertising blitz that big money can buy.
Yeah, I'm getting tears in my eyes, but I'm going to try and carry on. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for The Old Mole. I'm talking to Steve Early, who's a journalist, a wonderful writer and speaker. His most recent book is Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of American City. He's going to be in Portland this weekend to talk a lot more about how it was done in Richmond. Steve, let's tell us some of the policies they are pursuing, the most vivid examples. And many of them are alternatives to Trumpism, ways of structuring cities and communities that vary a whole lot from what the Trump people think is a proper way of life on almost every issue. Why don't you choose a few? I noticed that Big Soda got beaten in Chevron as well for one of the many issues. Talk about, let's say, housing, and let's talk about energy as well.
Well, even though for more than a century, Richmond has been a refinery town dominated first by Standard Oil and now its successor, Chevron, progressives and their liberal democratic allies, including our current mayor, who's not part of the Richmond Progressive Alliance, have done a lot to promote environmental protection as best they can at the local level, to encourage measures to curb global warming. Ironically, Richmond has one of the highest subscription rates for what's called community choice aggregation. We have an option here called Marin Clean Energy, and Pacific Gas and Electric customers can choose to have 50 to 100% of their electricity supplied from renewable sources like solar and wind and bioenergy and hydroelectric power. So Richmond has thousands of customers who switch to this option. It also the city has a climate action plan that systematically promotes community health and environmental goals in a way that's very contrary, obviously, to the spirit, the deregulatory thrust of the Trump administration. And a new solar farm just opened that's going to generate more power locally for those who choose the Marin Clean Energy option. So there's lots of things that cities can do and will have to do over the next 4 years to try to protect what's left of the environment, slow the process of global warming, while at the same time fighting the things that Trump and his appointees are doing at the federal level.
Yeah, in California's community choice program, cities and counties, in fact, any jurisdiction can set up their own, basically their own energy, my understanding is their own energy agency with the power to issue bonds and also the power to contract with people or organizations, small companies to produce and supply them with power. How is Chevron moving in that direction? I know Alameda County.
The Marin Clean Energy now serves about 250,000 customers in two counties and six mayor's cities, including Richmond. And Richmond has the highest participation rate.
Mm-hmm. Are they producing their own energy as well, though?
I mean, there's a new project coming that will employ more local people and generate power locally. That's kind of the next phase of participation in community choice aggregation. But up until now, it's been a kind of educational program to try to get people to switch, in effect, from the for-profit option, PG&E, to this not-for-profit, you know, public electricity supplier.
And PG&E is fighting them all the way.
The for-profit power company, long also very influential in California politics, has done everything it has been able to do in Sacramento and through the Public Utilities Board to impede the development of this program. But it has a strong base of support now, and you know, people were frustrated about the lack of progress that we're going to make at the federal level, the national level, dealing with environmental issues over the next 4 years, I think, are understanding, if they didn't before, the importance of these local initiatives.
Right. And let's get back to Richmond. Your energy program, for example, it is really community and democratically run, is my sense. You really reach out to bring in people and reach out to get support for these programs, and people are really involved.
Well, one of the best examples of that was the 18-month to 2-year campaign for rent control. Richmond last fall became one of the first cities in California in 30 years to introduce rent regulation. There was a ballot measure that accomplished that. It was approved by a 2-to-1 margin. And it rolled back rents to the level of a year before. It created a rent board that's still being assembled. And it also imposed an even broader requirement on landlords that they have just cause for evicting their tenants. So this was a response, a city-level response, to the crisis of housing affordability in the Bay Area. There's been lots of displacement of lower-income tenants from San Francisco and now from Oakland. People are moving here. Landlords were raising rents. People were being forced out. And the rent control campaign mobilized hundreds, if not thousands, of Black and Latino tenants. And it was a great victory and helped us elect 2 more progressive city council members who were the top candidates in a field of 9 because they were the strongest proponents and really the only really committed supporters of rent control on the ballot last fall.
Yeah, Steve, we have to close. I think we should close with your coming to Portland this next weekend with a whole lot more on how Richmond did it. And there are groups in Portland who are going to be at his talks to give out information, who are thinking of trying to set up a citywide alliance of the somewhat different than Richmond's, but with a similar thrust and struggle to build real alternatives in the face of dark times. Anyway, Steve, you're talking, Sunday night?
Sunday night at First Unitarian Church at 7. That's 1211 Southwest Main Street. And
right.
Monday night at Portland State University. And it's really going to be a two-way exchange. We've got some great local sponsors, the Working Families Party, the Faculty Association, Adjuncts Union, folks that are involved in housing struggles locally and attempts to develop forms for independent political action. So I'm going to learn as much as anybody locally is going to learn about Richmond and take back here the lessons of what people are doing to make Portland a more progressive city as well.
Steve, thanks a lot. See you this weekend. So long.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
And thanks, Bill. We've reached the end of today's Old Mole Variety Hour. Many thanks to Desiree Helligers and Ramon Ramirez for their discussion of ice raids in Woodburn. To Jan Hocken and Patsy Kullberg for their conversation about Patsy's new book, On the Ragged Edge of Medicine, Doctoring Among the Dispossessed. And to Bill Resnick and Steve Early for keeping us updated about the political work being done in Richmond. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer today has been Joe Clement. Remember, you can listen to this show again or any parts you might have missed, as well as past shows, by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. You'll find there additional information about our guests and topics. Today's show should be up in a day or two. Tune in again next Monday morning at 9 for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective. And stay tuned to KBOO, because at 10 this morning, right away, Chris Andre will be hosting Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein welcomes the National Wildlife Federation to outline ways to fight back against Trump's war on science. At 11, Health Watch talks to Peggy Orenstein,
author of the New York Times bestseller Girls and Sex, about the generation gap that has emerged between parents and their daughters. At 11:30, Between the Lines Radio brings you a roundup of the week's underreported stories. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not now a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Dark Circle, is showing Thursday, March 16th at 7 p.m. Dark Circle is a documentary film that focuses on the connections between the nuclear weapons and the nuclear power industries. Again, that's Dark Circle, Thursday, March 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good.